science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, indeed. It is now time for Dear Science. We've got Alan Blackman from AUT joining us here in the studio. Kia ora, Alan.
Hi, Shamina.
How are you doing?
I am very well.
Getting back to the swing of things of New Zealand life, away from your travels.
Yes, I know. Yes, it takes a bit of getting into it.
Yeah. But catching up, but then also like, oh, damn, being on holiday was real nice. Anyway, but first up.
Conference week,
we will be talking about some of your the things that you experienced during your travels later on the in the segment. But first, we're talking about how a peer reviewer stole and published data by another author. Talk to me about this.
Okay. So in order to sort of appreciate this and plus the other story that we're going to talk about, we've really got to talk in detail about how scientific reports or how scientific data is disseminated throughout the world, basically. So you're in the lab, you're doing all your experiments, you've got these great results, you write a paper, and then you submit it to a journal to get it published. So that's the way that the rest of the world gets to find out about what you've been doing. So when it comes to submitting to a journal, the way that it works, you've got your paper all typed up and everything, you submit it on an online portal generally, and then the manuscript goes to an editor of that particular journal. Now, journals can have one editor, they can have a whole hat full, depending on the particular journal. And it's those editors that then decide what happens to the manuscript at that point, whether or not it goes out to these people called peer reviewers. Mm-hmm. And the job of a peer reviewer is to judge the worth of the manuscript, the scientific worth, I guess, of the manuscript, whether it's good enough to be able to be published in the particular journal. And as I've said before on this program, there's a whole lot of sort of rankings of journals. You've got the very, very good ones. You've got your Natures, your Sciences, your Proceedings, the National Academy of Sciences, et cetera, et cetera, down to the average ones and down to the rubbish ones, which we'll talk more about later. So, you know, if you've got a really, really high quality paper, you submit it to a really high quality journal, they send it out to high quality peer reviewers. And as I said, the job of the peer reviewer is to read critically the manuscript, point out any flaws, errors, and then they've got basically three choices. They can accept it as is, they can accept it with some revisions, or they can reject it. Mm. And it's very, 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 very rare that a paper gets accepted with no revisions whatsoever. Perfect papers don't exist.
Yeah.
So generally what happens is most of the time you get a letter back saying, we'll accept it, but you've got to make these little changes. You make the changes, goes back to the editor, they make sure that everything's been changed, blah, 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 and then it gets published. Mm. So that's the peer review system, and it really sort of operates on sort of implied honesty, I guess, because you are submitting your unpublished results, which may be earth-shattering, may be worth a Nobel Prize, you never know, and you are giving them away to complete strangers, and you don't know who those complete strangers are in terms of peer review. It's all an anonymous process. And so you're submitting those to people who, if they really wanted to, could steal your results and publish them elsewhere. And sadly, that has happened more than a few times in the literature, and there's a recent example that we're talking about. So the journal was called the Elementary Pharmacology and Therapeutics Journal. And
in terms of how it sits compared to other journals, is it quite up there or middle range?
It's not my field, but I'd say it's probably sort of middle range sort of thing. It's quite unusual that this sort of thing goes on in very, very good journals, because you're going to get found out quite quickly. If you're going to do this sort of thing, the trick is to sort of do it in journals that are not brilliant, so that nobody sort of reads them.
You can get away with it.
So that you can get away with it, yeah. Yeah. And all that people are worried about these days, not point of academia, but a lot of academia is all about publish, publish, publish.
Yes.
And you've got to get those papers on your CV, and you oftentimes it doesn't matter how good the journals are that you're publishing in, you just need papers, 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 and then the bean counters then think, oh, this is good, they're publishing lots of papers, they must be really good, let's give them lots of money, sort of thing. And sadly, that's the way that academia is heading and has been heading for quite a while. So it's really important that you've got to publish. And So one easy way of publishing is stealing somebody else's results and passing them off as your own, which has happened in this particular case. Some authors in China published a paper, actually a review paper, in this particular journal. And then a couple of months after that, the paper was retracted. And that's a relatively rare thing to happen, yeah. Is that a paper gets retracted. And the editor said that it was retracted basically because it contained material that could only have been accessible through the peer review process for another journal. And so that's quite a terse
very
sort
suspicious.
Of... a very terse explanation. Often when papers are rejected, you don't get the whole story. It's just normally sort of a one sentence. This paper has been rejected because of plagiarism or something like that. Yeah. They never really go into detail. And it's the same with this one as well. So... they're basically saying that one of the authors of this Chinese paper obtained a manuscript to review for another journal. They stole some data out of that manuscript from the other journal and published it in this particular journal. And, you know, that's just not on.
Yeah.
And sadly, it used to be an absolute rarity, but now it's becoming more and more common. There's actually a website set up, a thing called retractionwatch.com, and this paper is dedicated, or this website is dedicated solely to papers that have been retracted from the literature, generally for fraudulent behavior. That's pretty much the way that you get a paper retracted.
I see. So, yeah, so depressing though, because yeah, I guess it just undermines that trust that exists in the academic community. Mm-hmm. With a peer review process, I mean, trusting people to check your work and give you robust feedback,
yep.
And that it's all about contributing to, I don't know, the greater good, like creating knowledge.
Absolutely, and that's what science is meant to be all about. It's not...
not this competition.
Right, yes. Yeah. So, you know, science itself is pure. It's the practitioners of science that aren't, unfortunately. And, you know, it just takes a couple of rat bags to ruin it for everybody. So when these sorts of things happen, then you're right. You do start losing trust in this process, which is, you know, very, very delicately balanced and does rely completely on trust.
Mm. What kind of repercussions come from this? Like, if it's found, like these guys were obviously evidently found,
yeah.
What happens after that? Is it just the paper gets pulled or...
Well, that's a really, really good question. And again, there should be probably more transparency in this. Yes, the paper gets pulled, number one, but then it's very, very rare that you find out what happens at the author's institution, okay? Because this will be reported to the chancellor or the vice chancellor or whatever, whichever particular university these guys are from. And then it's very unusual that you actually find out what happens, whether they get a rap over the knuckles or whether they're gone or whatever. So if you do want to know that, you've really got to basically keep a track of the literature and look out for these people's names and see if they keep publishing in the scientific literature. If they do, then you can assume that you know, they got a rap over the knuckles. If they don't,
yeah,
then you can assume something possibly worse for them anyway. So
yeah,
I guess it just sort of reflects that increasing pressure on academics, though, to churn out research. I know that that sort of it's been growing and growing and growing.
Absolutely, yes.
So,
yeah. And that sort of segues nicely into the second story.
Yeah, our next topic. A curious story about someone called Dr. Fraud.
Indeed. So because of this pressure to publish, not only are academics resorting to nefarious practices, but also nefarious people are resorting to nefarious practices, in that anybody can set up a journal. Absolutely anybody. So all you need is a web page and an editorial board, basically. So you've got yourself a web page, a nice cover design, editorial board, pictures of people from all over the planet and everything, and all of a sudden you're journal looks kosher when it's not. Now, there's two types of journals. There's the journals that you just submit the paper to and you don't have to pay anything to get published. And there's also the journals where you do have to pay to get published, okay? So the first type of journals, they go on subscriptions, basically. So for libraries and stuff like that, so they make their money out of subscriptions. The second ones, obviously, they make their money out of people paying to get into the journals, paying to get published. And these are called open access journals because basically they're open for everybody to see. So the subscription journals, the ones online, they're only available if you've actually got a subscription to that particular journal. So Auckland University and AUT, et cetera, you know, they'll subscribe to truckloads of journals. And there'll be some that they don't subscribe to, which the students here won't have access to. But the open access journals, everybody's free to see them because they're making their money from people paying to get published.
Isn't that almost a fundamentally flawed model? Because if they want to say,
you spotted it,
go away with your research, we don't want it, it's problem, it's, you know, it's flawed, you've stolen somebody's data or you've plagiarized, then they're not going to get the money.
Yeah, well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? But sadly, these types of journals are proliferating all over the web. And sadly, there's a lot of gullible academics out there who, needing stuff on their CV, okay, want to publish quickly, and these journals are going to accept anything. You pay them, you know, $500, you'll be in print the next week because they promise that their peer review will be very quick and almost always positive, okay, which means all the time. So a couple of academics, one in England and a few in Poland, decided to test this and to see whether or not they could sort of play the system, I guess. And so what they did was choose 360 journals, and 120 of them were very prestigious ones, 120 of them were good open access journals, and the other 120 were bad open access journals. They're so-called predatory journals, which basically accept money for publication. You pay the money, you will get published. No peer review or anything like that, despite their protestations to the contrary. So they invented a fictitious Dr. Anna Ozust. And Ozust in Polish means fraud. So her name was Dr. Fraud. They made up a CV for her, which was, again, entirely fictitious. All of the journals listed in her CV didn't exist. None of the book chapters existed. None of the publishing houses existed. And then what they did was to send the CV off to these 360 journals and said, hey, I'd really, really like to be on your editorial board. How about it, basically? And so of the 120 prestigious journals, none of them accepted her. Of the prestigious open access journals, 8 accepted her. And of the others, 40 accepted her. So she got accepted onto the editorial boards of 48 journals.
It's insane.
With a completely made-up CV. And so these journals that accepted her were saying, oh, we'll accept you maybe if you give us a payment, you know, we'll put you on the editorial board. They wanted her to submit papers or to get her colleagues to submit papers to these journals because, of course, they're going to make money out of that. They wanted her to organise conferences, and they'd have a 60-40 split of the proceeds of the conference, so the publishers would get 60%, she'd get 40%. I mean, it's just a joke that that this sort of stuff goes on. But sadly, it really does. And, you know, I get, probably 5-10 emails a week from these sorts of people saying, publish with us, we're the best, you know, blah, 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 blah.
I was just thinking that when I was teaching at AUT, that I would get so many emails just, you know, I guess maybe, I didn't even know how they got my email address.
Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, just from fake journals being like, pay some money and we'll publish you.
Yes, yeah. And it's absolutely, absolutely terrible. And sadly, as I say, there's a lot of gullible academics out there that need the CV padding, I guess, as we call it. And so, you know, they'll publish anywhere. And it's got to be stopped.
Yeah. So what is being done to stop this?
Well, very interesting. There was a very brave librarian by the name of Jeffrey Beale in the States. Mm. And he basically coined the term predatory journals, and the definition of those being basically journals who will accept money in exchange for guaranteed payment, publication. And so he ran a web page, and I think he was at University of Colorado, I believe. And what he did was to list all of these predatory journals on the web page. It's a very, very brave thing to do. And funnily enough, earlier this year, that list disappeared. So you go to that website now and it just said page not found, unfortunately. Oh, so he has obviously come under some pressure from either his university or from lawsuits or whatever, because that's the way the US runs. From these people who run these predatory journals. And, that's just really, really sad. I think there's been a mirror site or two set up around the world to sort of...
To keep
it going. Yeah. But, you know, when you come under the pressure of legal threats and stuff like that, it's very, very hard to ignore those, sadly. And I don't know what else can be done to stop all this except educating all the academics around the world and just saying, look, for God's sake, don't go publishing in these particular journals, because it just exacerbates the whole situation.
Yeah, but I mean, so just this guy was doing that. Why is this not something that universities are taking a stronger approach towards? Because surely it's in their best interests to also quash these journals.
Indeed, and I'm sure the universities are coming under legal threat as well. I'm sure the University of Colorado must have come under pressure. I'm pretty sure, as I say, that's where he's from. But, I guarantee that there'll be, Bush lawyers out there busy serving...
Right, so take this down and it'll go away.
Yeah, basically, yeah. What the US does have is a thing called the Office of Research Integrity, and they are tasked with looking into more sort of fraud, I guess, more sort of the first thing that we were talking about, so sort of stealing results and that sort of thing. And that is a purely transparent process, and you do find out what happens to people in that case, and they generally... are told that they can't apply for federal funding for 3 years or 5 years or something like that, which does seem to be a very, very small price to pay for fraud, So I think, people need to be tougher on it, I think. And, basically, as I say, education is probably the key here. And if nobody submitted papers to these things, they would cease to exist. So obviously the fact that they're still out there means that people are still being sucked in, sadly.
And so finally, perhaps on a lighter, more happy note, let's talk about a turtle reserve that you visited in Oman during your recent trip to the Middle East.
Indeed. So, not so much holiday, but conference leave.
Apologies. /holiday, though.
So... I had to go to a conference in Cyprus, as you do. So Cyprus is a wonderful place, and I would thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. We went to the northern part as well, which is occupied by Turkey, and so had to go across the UN demilitarized zone and all that, and that's a very interesting experience, etc., etc. And then my partner had a conference in Berlin that I had to go to as well, so went to Berlin for a few days. And then on the way home, we thought, let's go to Oman, because it's next to Dubai, and flying through there anyway. And Oman is a wonderful, wonderful country. I'd say probably it's the safest Arab country on the planet at the moment, I would guess. Modern but not glitzy like Dubai.
Mm.
And... we stayed out in the desert in a tent and all that stuff that you do when you're in that part of the world. But one place that we did go to was the turtle reserve, the Ras Al Jinns Turtle Reserve, which we knew absolutely nothing about before we went. And so this is it's a turtle research lab, which is basically a building on the very, very easternmost tip of Oman. And on these beaches, turtles basically come and lay their eggs, all sorts of turtles, but mostly the green turtles. And these guys are big suckers. They can grow up to about 1.5 meters
wow.
in length. And so what they do is that they take you out at night after sundown onto the beach, and it's very sort of highly regulated and stuff. And you can go and see these big turtles laying eggs. And so they've got to dig these enormous holes in the sand, and they dig these decoy holes for the foxes, because the foxes come and eat the eggs as well. So, and you can imagine digging a hole with your flippers when you're 1.5 meters in size takes a while.
Pretty long time.
And so that was utterly, utterly amazing. Once in a lifetime experience, sitting there watching a turtle laying eggs on the beach. And then in the morning, that's when the eggs hatch, not the ones that have just been laid, obviously, but,
That's a really fast incubation process.
Indeed. But the eggs hatch in the morning, and then you get to see these little guys, which are about 5-10 centimeters long, and away they go, and they're just hightailing it for the water. And that was just utterly amazing, absolutely extraordinary. The sad thing being that 2 in 1,000 make it to maturity.
Oh.
So all of these little guys.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Why is it so bad?
Well, okay, on the beach you've got these crabs, which are enormous, and they're just sort of standing there waiting for these little guys. And you've got the foxes, which eat the eggs. You've got all sorts of birds, which are hanging around to grab them as well. Then you've got everything in the sea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so really, really sadly, so we made sure that the crabs didn't get any of these guys. We might have given them a bit of a helping hand possibly, but oh no, it's just a really, really amazing experience. So turtles are very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, when you sent me a link about it before, made me think about how there are obviously cases of good animal tourism that exists in the world as well as not so good ones.
Yeah, yeah,
and from
yeah.
what I could read about your one, it seems pretty ethical, but obviously there are cases of not so great ones. I mean, I know in Southeast Asia with elephant tourism is
notorious
trade.
Yeah, this is great. It's, you know, it's all basically natural, and they limit it. They limit the number of people that are allowed on the beach, et cetera, et cetera. So,
right, so it's really regulated and carefully done.
Yeah,
awesome.
Very much so. So, yeah, if people listening, if you're ever close to Oman, I would really, really highly recommend it. Wonderful place.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us today, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll see you again next week.
Shall do. Thanks, Amina.
That was Dear Science.
It was indeed.